Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I sent my chef de cuisine down to cook for Michelle Obama with those 12 dishes. And then from there, she picked 4 dishes.
And was the president of China there?
Yes.
So did you cook dumplings for him, or did
no?
Did you actually get to hang with the Obamas when you actually did the dinner?
It was sort of like a wedding line. It was the Obamas and the Xis were there, and then we all walked through and shook their hands and took a picture. And then
this week, sitting across the table from me in CDM Studios is none other than Chef Anita Lowe, the author of the delightful new book Solo, a modern cookbook for a party of one. Welcome to Special Sauce, the talented
you,
and super smart Anita Lowe. What a great book you've written, and what a great story you have to tell. So we're going to get to both of them. First of all, I can't tell you how much I miss Anissa.
Oh, thank you.
The last time I was there, I think I was there with Tom Douglas from Seattle and his wife.
Oh, lovely.
I don't know if you miss the grind, but you probably miss the cooking.
There's things about it that I miss.
Anissa, for those of you who don't know, was Anita's restaurant in the West Village, which lasted for 17 years.
Yes.
You know, 17 years in restaurant years is dog years. So it's really 119 years.
I should be dead.
Yeah, you should be dead.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right, so let's start at the beginning, which in your case is particularly interesting, to me at least. Tell us about life at the Lowe family table.
I grew up in a very multicultural household. My parents both worked. My mother was Chinese from Malaysia, which is sort of the crossroads of Asia, because there was, you know, Malay influence, Indian influence, et cetera. And my father, who was from Shanghai, died when I was 3.
Wow.
So I grew up mostly with my stepfather, who was...
You say he's a wasp in the book.
Wasp, yeah.
He's a high wasp.
Yeah, he had his family had one of those blue books, you know? Like, maybe they came over on the Mayflower, something like that, yeah. Yeah.
and this was in suburban Michigan?
Yep. Yeah, anywhere, USA.
And what was life like at the table?
We had a lot of great food. My mom was a wonderful cook. She worked, you know, 14 hours a day and would come home and put like 6 dishes on the table because she loved it.
Really?
But we also had different things like my, you know, we had nannies taking care of us. So, and they were from different places.
Comes in handy. You know, you get to have nannies. I know, because I was reading your book, and it was like, you had like, it said, oh, we had a live-in Hungarian, you know, caretaker, you know, caregiver.
Yeah, she was lovely. She was the best thing. Yeah, I grew up with chicken paprikash. That was one of my favorites growing up. So,
but your mom would cook, even though she worked.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, not every day, because we had our nannies, but... actually, most of the time, I think, if I remember correctly.
And were you interested? Like, were you one of these people that stood up on a chair and watched your mom cook?
I did. I mean, not all the time. I don't think we helped her that much. But sometimes we did. I do remember making, like, eggplant fritters with her. And certainly, like, we had that Chinese tradition of making dumplings on Sunday mornings sometimes. Where the whole family would get together and fold dumplings.
And did you always remember looking forward to meals? Like, was food actually a pretty big thing to you early on, or was it just fuel?
No, it was a huge thing early on. My parents were obsessed with food. We traveled quite a bit, and everywhere we went, it was, you know, we'd have to decide. We'd do research and try to figure out what the best things to eat were from that area, and then we'd go find it. And, when we were eating breakfast, we'd talk about what we were eating for dinner, et cetera. So.
Now, your father, who died when you were 3, you mentioned in the book that he survived the Cultural Revolution in China. And, you know, another Special Sauce guest, Helen Yu of Galaxy Dumpling in Flushing, had a father who was imprisoned during the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah.
And she and her mom were ostracized in their community and her at the school where she went. So she stopped going to school and she just would make dumplings with her mother all the time and then go on this 18-hour journey to bring them to her father in prison.
Oh, my God.
How was your father affected by the Cultural Revolution?
He was sort of the black sheep of the family. And I'm probably getting a lot of this wrong because, you know, he died when I was three. And I don't know, my family didn't talk about a lot
right.
of hard things. But from what I know, he walked out of the country just to escape it. And apparently all of his brothers suffered for that because, you know, they had someone who left the
fold.
Yeah, and so they were sent off to the, you know, to the countryside to work. And, you know, I just remember one of them came to visit within the last 10 years. And, you know, he was talking about how they would eat this rice gruel, like, and that's all they would get to eat. You know, it would be like water with a little bit of rice.
My dad was raised by a single mother. And when his mother would take a lover, she would put my dad in a foster home or an orphanage, and they would feed him oatmeal all the time. And so my father had this abject hatred of oatmeal. I bet your uncle didn't much care for rice gruel after that.
Oh my God, that's so, yeah. It's like Dickensian.
So, you know, in the book, you also talk about distancing yourself from your Asian heritage. How did that come about?
I grew up in Michigan. I grew up in the suburbs of Michigan. It was, you know, I think I was one of two Asians in my entire school, which was a pretty big school.
I've talked to Roy Choi about this, and they weren't allowed to speak anything but English in his Korean-American household in Los Angeles because his parents believed so strongly that he should be fully assimilated.
Right. You know, there was that Chinese Exclusion Act and the McCarthy era, you know. The Asian communities just decided to, you know, to make themselves as small as possible.
Sure. Especially post-internment camps. Right,
exactly. All of that, yeah.
So did you always know you wanted to be a chef?
No. When I was very young, I thought I would become a doctor like my mother was. And then in college, you know, I was majoring in French, and I'm not quite sure what you do with a French degree. But
I when I read that, I was like, Anita just wanted an excuse to go to France and eat.
Well, that's exactly how, you know, I mean, it's embarrassing. But yes, yeah, that is exactly how it came about. But I thought I would be a go work in the UN and translate or something like that. And then I ended up wanting to go back to Paris again to eat, and I ended up in cooking school, and I did very well, and I was learning how to cook for myself anyway, and studying French, which was, you know, a big foodie culture, and fell in love with it. And so once I graduated, I went to work at Boulay.
And what was that like? Because, you know, you hear so many stories about David Boulay as a, you know, as an eccentric, to say the least.
Certainly. He's a brilliant eccentric. Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, you know, we did know that what we were making was exceptional.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we worked long hours at Boulay as well, but in France we worked ridiculous hours.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you feel that as a woman you were at a disadvantage?
Certainly, on some level. But at the same time, you know, my mother had been a doctor. And there were very, very few female doctors, I think, at the time when she became a doctor. And I think she was the only female doctor in her hospital, or at least in her hospital wing. That was my role model. So I just knew you had to endure, yeah.
Yeah. And did you get the hazing, the sort of go lift that 200-pound stock pot by yourself, even though they didn't ever ask a man to do that kind of thing?
No, I didn't get that, but you know, we did get some, you know, sort of nasty banter that
right.
that was meant to make you not feel welcome.
Right, right. Which now, as you know, if the culture is changing, you're probably less likely to encounter, but not you're certainly still going to encounter it, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, we still have a long way to go.
Yeah.
Certainly.
At what point did you decide that you wanted to own your own restaurant, and how did you go about doing that?
You know, after seeing what it was like to own a restaurant, I was like, oh, God, I never want to do that. I remember saying that to David Boulay. He's like, then why are you doing this? And but I was too young at the time. I just didn't realize it. And I guess after my job at Morezzi.
And what was Morezzi?
Morezzi was a Pan-Asian restaurant on Lower Fifth Avenue.
Oh, right. That's right.
Yeah, it was owned by the Samsung Corporation, or the Chel Jaejong Corporation, which is a subsidiary of Samsung. It was great. It was a great learning experience. But I realized that that category was too narrow for me, and I wanted to have a contemporary American restaurant. And I wanted full creative freedom, and I realized that the only way to get that was to open my own place.
Yes, welcome to the world of Ed Levine and Serious Eats. Why did Ed Levine start Serious Eats? For the same reason you started Anissa. Because you didn't want any gatekeepers. You didn't want anybody you had to pitch.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you go about doing it? Because especially at that time, there weren't that. I mean, there was Ann Rosenzweig at Arcadia.
Right.
I think I may have to stop there.
Yeah.
In New York.
Yeah, this is true. But growing up in the household that I grew up in, I knew that it wasn't about gender. So that I could do this. There's no reason why I couldn't do that. You know, whether or not it was going to be successful or not is always a question. But it took us a while. We found a spot. It took 2 years to find a spot. And we opened it on a relative dime. I mean, it was a lot of money.
Right, but, at the time.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, compared to what most people spend on opening restaurants, we did pretty well with our budget.
Yeah. And were you trotting around a business plan and doing the whole thing? And
yeah, absolutely. We wrote a business plan. I went to Pace University. There's a small business, like a free small business advisory. It was great, yeah.
And who was your partner?
Jennifer Sism. She was my partner in life at the time. And she had worked for Ann Rosenzweig. And she had been her chef de cuisine at the Lobster Club.
Oh, yes. I remember the Lobster Club.
Right. She had been my sous chef at one point at Cannes Restaurant.
Uh-huh.
And so we decided to open this together because otherwise we were never going to see each other. And probably a bad idea, though, in retrospect. You know, restaurants sort of kill relationships. But we did do well for a while. Yeah, she decided to go to the front of the house, and so I set her up with Karen Waltuck down at Chanterelle, and she
learned
how to do it.
David Waltuck's wife and the restaurateur side of Chanterelle.
Yes.
What did you do? Like, how did you develop a clientele? Like, how did people develop a clientele back then? Like, was it just you were waiting to be reviewed?
Yeah, I think we were. Although I had been reviewed at Morezzi, and we had gotten 2 stars from the New York Times there. So I had a little bit of a name and, you know, I think, well, at least within the food community.
There was a buzz.
Yeah.
A little bit of it.
So
yeah.
People were coming, you know, they knew. And then we got Food & Wine Best New Chef, so that helped a lot, yeah.
And who was the greatest influence on you as a budding chef restaurateur when you opened?
The Waltucks.
The Waltucks.
For sure, yeah.
And they were famous for being very generous people.
Yeah, they were great. Yeah, that was a great place to work. I learned a lot.
And Chanterelle was really the first important restaurant in Tribeca when Tribeca wasn't even a neighborhood that people wanted to live in.
Right.
If you decided to do it again, would you face the same set of issues? I know, like Amanda Cohn always talks about now, that women chef restaurateurs are never offered the best locations, have a harder time finding money. Did you find that to be true then? And do you think it's still true now?
I definitely think it's still true now. I don't think it's something, for the most part, that's done in a mean way. I think it's something that is embedded in people's minds, and it just sort of happens.
Yeah.
I just think we're wired culturally to support men. And to see men as leaders and see men as the money makers. And that leaves a lot of smart, talented women behind.
Yeah. Maybe they've got a little better and maybe they haven't.
Well, we've at least we're talking about it, and just because we've had a Me Too moment doesn't mean that bad things aren't still aren't happening. I mean, look what's happening in our government.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yes, for sure. So Anissa lasted a long time, and you also survived a fire.
Oh, God. Well, on some level, thank God Jen was there. I think it was 2009, I went out. Jen and I had been split up by that time. I went out to Long Island because I have a small apartment here, and then I have a small house out there. And I went out there for the weekend, went to bed, and I got a phone call in the middle of the night that said that the restaurant was burning.
Wow.
And, yeah, and it was just a bad year for me. So, it like, I think my... Yeah, I actually had a fire at Bar Q. I had to close Bar Q.
Right. Bar Q was a second restaurant on Bleecker, if I remember.
Yeah, it was on Bleecker. Yeah, just like a half a block from me.
And it was like your version of a Korean barbecue place.
Or Asian-ish,
sort of
yeah.
Asian barbecue place.
Yeah.
I forgot about that restaurant. I knew you had a second restaurant.
Yeah. I made a lot of mistakes, but it was also 2009
hey,
and a whole bunch of
you know that I've
things,
never made a mistake in
oh,
my
really?
Life?
Oh, really? Oh.
Isn't that great? So if you ever wanted to know what someone would look like who hasn't made a mistake.
There we go.
So you closed Bar Q that year, too?
Closed Bar Q that year. My mom died. It was just a bad, bad year. And I think I was just sort of shut down on some level.
Wow.
Yeah, so, oh, God, it was awful. And there wasn't much you can do, really. I mean, all this, you have to wait and wait for insurance, and that takes forever. And then we found out that we weren't really insured well enough because we had insured it, pretty much a decade before for
right.
what we thought was enough, and then we hadn't increased our coverage over the years. And, there was at least three occasions where I was like, okay, we're done. But
so,
then somehow we pulled through.
Yeah, so how long was it before you reopened?
It took 9 months.
9 months.
Yeah.
And then after that, the restaurant lasted another few years, right?
Yeah, then it lasted another 8.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what happened? Like, what did you sense was going on when the restaurant had to close?
There were many, many reasons why I closed it then. And
you had a rough few years.
Yeah, I just had a bad knee replacement that I had to be off the line at that point. And then, the lack of cooks was just... like soul crushing,
right?
Me. Like,
which has only gotten worse.
Yeah, and I was like, you know what, I can't do this anymore. Like, I don't. There's, and I was getting angry at my cooks because I was hiring people like that didn't have any experience, and it wasn't their fault, you know. And I didn't like who I was becoming, and it was like, you know, on top of all of the squeezes with the monetary issues with our real estate taxes, like, going up. It just, they suddenly jumped. I don't know why.
Was it a relief in some ways?
Oh, it was a great relief, yeah. Yeah, it was the right decision. I mean, I was burnt out. It was time. Do I wish, it would have been nicer to just go through your entire lease and,
right.
have it be it was a celebratory closing on some level.
So you were,
but
you first were literally burnt out, and then you were figuratively burnt out.
Yeah,
you were burnt out squared.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then you also were involved with Rickshaw Dumpling. So we should explain that Rickshaw Dumpling was a fast casual dumpling concept which got a lot of attention, and I feel that chefs are always drawn to fast casual concepts. Because they always think that it must be easier than opening a real restaurant and that it can scale more easily and they can make money while they sleep. There's this list of things that they tick off in their head.
Right.
Was that what went on with you?
It wasn't my concept.
Uh-huh.
I was approached by Kenny Lau.
Oh, right. I remember Kenny Lau.
Yeah.
Used to work for Drew, I think.
Yeah. It was his concept. And so I ended up signing on. And I actually left before they closed. I think I left a couple of years before they closed. I left and then they closed like a year or two later. Yeah.
So Anissa closes. And did you at that point decide, you know what, I really don't want to cook anymore for a living. I don't want to be behind the stoves.
No, not at all. I love
really?
Cooking. Yeah, that's not the thing. It's the cooking part is the great
other
part.
Stuff.
Yeah. I don't want to own another restaurant. I would love to consult, to have a long-term consulting gig, you know, that I could do physically, you know, set up and sort of walk away and then check in and make sure everything's running smoothly. Yeah, and then I'll continue to write books. And I've also been doing some hosting of travel, of culinary travel. With,
tours.
With the Tour de Forks.
Uh-huh. But if someone offered you, say, a Danny Meyer restaurant and said, oh, Anissa, we'd love you to be the executive chef. That's probably not what you want to do anymore, right? Like to be a chef for somebody else?
No, not really. I mean, I guess consulting would kind of be like that.
Except but you're not on the line every night.
Yeah, I can't be on the line every night. Just because, you know, it's just my knees are not, I just don't have any knees left, really.
Yeah.
So.
No knees makes it hard to be on the line.
Exactly, yeah.
So you have no cartilage. People say they have no knees. I know because I've had cartilage shaved on both knees.
Yeah, I had that several times.
Yeah. All sports injuries.
Yeah, and now I have a fake one. I literally worked myself to the bone. So.
Right. Our crack research team, you know, that I have 75 people that have been studying you for 3 months now, came up with the fact that you were the first woman chef to cook at the White House for President Obama in terms of a guest chef.
For a state dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, people have been getting that wrong. They've been saying, oh, the first women chef invited to the White House. That's not true. First woman
to cook a state dinner.
Yeah.
And was the president of China there?
Yes.
So did you cook dumplings for him? Or did
No.
you didn't want him to feel like you were culturally stereotyping him.
Well, that doesn't work that way. But
so what was the menu?
Well, they asked me to create a menu that is Chinese influenced, but clearly American. And so that was very difficult for me because it was, as much as I bring in Chinese influence into my food, I don't have a ton of recipes that I've made over the years that are Chinese influenced. But I do have that dumpling, but there was no way I was going to do that for 250 people. And so I had to come up with 12. I was leaving for, I found out about it. I was leaving in 3 days for India. And so I had to come up, with 12 recipes that were, you know, that you could do for banquets, you know, that, because it's not the same as working doing it in an a la carte kitchen, a restaurant kitchen. So, I was pulling things from like decades prior. And I sent my chef de cuisine down to cook for Michelle Obama with those 12 dishes. And then from there, she picked 4 dishes.
That's interesting. And so did you actually get to hang with the Obamas when you actually did the dinner, or at least for 30 seconds?
30 seconds. I met them, yeah.
You got your 30 seconds?
Yeah, it was awesome. I've got a picture with them. I shook their hands. It was sort of like a wedding line. It was the Obamas and the Xis were there, and then we all walked through and shook their hands and took a picture and then went out the other door. Yeah.
And was Sam Cass there?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Because he was on Special Sauce. And of course, he was involved with the Obama White House. But and then the last thing I want to ask you before we have to stop this episode is you've done a lot of TV, right? You've done Top Chef Masters and Iron Chef America. You've done Chopped. Is it fun? Is it good for business? Is it good for you personally?
It's definitely good for business. Definitely, definitely good for business. I would say that Top Chef Masters, like, you know, brought so much business to Anissa. Or all of it does. But Yeah, is it fun? It can be fun, you know. Was I ready to go home by the end of Top Chef Masters? I was like, yes, I'm very happy to pack my knives and go.
And how many seasons did you do?
Just one.
Just one.
Yeah, it was just, yeah. It was the first season.
Typical elimination.
Yeah.
And so you weren't disappointed that they didn't invite you back? Because people tell me it's a real grind.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible. I mean, no one wants to cook that way. But, yeah. I mean, I did go back as a judge at one point. Yeah.
That's much easier.
Exactly. Yeah.
I've been a judge on Iron Chef. It's really not hard.
Right. Well, yeah, I love that job. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of boring.
Really good at eating. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really good at eating and telling people what's right or wrong.
Right, exactly. Fun.
We're going to have to stop it right here, Anita, for this episode of Special Sauce. But thank you for telling us your life story on mic. And we'll get into Solo, A Modern Cookbook for a Party of One on the next episode.
Okay, great.
So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.